Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How's everybody doing? So one of those questions that you can't, like, don't answer all at once.
Excellent. How about yourself?
Good. Thank God. Thank God. Got a nice couple of beautiful days here all of a sudden. So things going to continue tomorrow. How's it going over there on the West Coast?
We had a couple of beautiful days, and the last couple of days we have the weather that gives us our reputation.
Oh, the overcast.
Overcast and rainy.
Well, you have a lot of catching up to do. I think I've never seen so much rain and wind in my life in New York.
Right. Good morning, everybody. Happy Mother's Day.
Good morning. Happy Mother's Day.
Morning, everybody. Hi, Happy Mother's Day. Beautiful in New York now. Rabbi, coming in.
Hello? You got a question?
Oh, no. I just said it's sunny and New York.
Okay, so I guess we'll start. I guess we're back in Kehelis. We just started chapter 9.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Can I ask a question from some of our previous stuff before we go there?
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
In that letter to Marseille, one of the comments that the Rambam makes is he comments about the philosopher's belief that the sun, I think it's in the stars, have a soul and thought. And then he indicates that he and the sages agree with that. Do you have any understanding of what that means or what's behind that?
I think that was a misconception that they had based on the motion of the spheres. I think he may go into it to the guy if you're perplexed. Because typical motion, or any motion really, is linear. Linear means a straight line. So I guess the word line comes from linear. So if anything which is set into motion, so depending on its angle and the force behind it, it'll have a specific trajectory, a certain arc. If you throw it upwards really high, it'll have a very acute arc. If you throw it more horizontal, the arc won't be that much. But it, in either case, it goes straight. But then the philosophers, even the rabbis, when they saw the spherical, or should it be circular? Spherical is a 3D image. Circular path of the planets and the stars. So they said this goes against typical motion. If I throw a ball, it doesn't keep on circling, endlessly, unless it has its own will. So they attributed will or intelligence to the spheres. But incorrectly, of course. We know that, there's nothing more. The Earth is also an inanimate thing. So that was an incorrect idea.
Okay, so just based on the incorrect ideas of science at the time.
Yeah. You had cases like that. You had cases like that, of course, because in your life you can't study every single area, let alone master every single area. So many times what happens is that there are certain things, I guess, they get either accepted. I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure, maybe that was an area that just didn't become explored, or I can't give the reasons what led them to that. And I don't know what I would have thought, had I lived back then.
Well, that helps. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there are many things that we can harbor for decades in our life, and just, if we're lucky enough, we wake up one day and say, well, why did I ever accept that? But certain things have just become so ingrained and in question that, so that's why it's very important to, a person has to, question everything. I was talking to somebody last week, and that person has a very firm belief in astrology and that certain numbers have powers. So, so I quoted them that exact, the letter to Marseille, where Maimonides says there's only three things that a person should accept as truth. that which your mind tells you is true, meaning you can deduce something or induce something, like 2 + 2 = 4. That's number one. You don't need any, you know, empirical evidence or any experience. Your mind alone can determine something. Number two, what you should accept is only that which you experience. So if I never experience a certain type of creature, I won't let my imagination think that since I can think of it, it's true. But if I experience a gray elephant that stands 8 feet tall, so then I know this thing is true. I experienced it. So experience is number two. Reason and logic is number one. And this is the last criteria for accepting something as truth, if it stems from the rabbis, from the Torah that we got from the prophets. Because then we know there's direct communication from God. So two have to do with human ability, and one has to do with authority, meaning something from God. So within human ability, there's sensory and there's intelligence. So those are the only two areas that we should trust. And when it comes to something outside of our sensations or outside of our logic, so the only thing which we trust is absolutely true is that which is communicated by God through the prophets, through the rabbis. Now, this error with the planets could be based on a certain step in reason. Because they experienced it, they saw the motion, and they made certain rules about how motion works in all cases. And here, there was a deviation. So they made certain conclusions based on that. For the person I was speaking to, they had this belief in astrology and numbers. So I said very simply, you don't have any evidence. Even though the world is accepting it and under the guise of Kabbalah or whatever, people are accepting it and big names are saying it, but the bottom line is, there's no evidence to whatever they would say. Since you're born on a certain month, a certain date, that's my mind, this whole thing in that letter. It takes away free will. It means that you have a certain proclivity, that you don't have the ability to have free choice because you were born in April instead of May. So that's against, the primary tenet of the Torah. The person, every human being has the ability to choose, make any decision he wants. But they have these, I guess it comes out of insecurity. People try to peg people. Or they want to try to, that's what all of this horoscopes, palm reading, and red, the red strings that a lot of Jews wear on their wrists, and certain numbers are lucky. So all these things are to fill in the gaps, which are the large part of a person's life. They just are so insecure, and they're looking for things that will give them comfort, that maps out how things will unfold. So there's nothing which is like an unknown, when in fact there's nothing wrong with venturing into life and facing what's unknown. I mean, you have laws of nature. You have things which are constant. So you can have a certain amount of understanding of how things will unfold. But that's a bit of security. The people, and that's, religion and idolatry, all this, all stems from that. That infantile state of needing the parent to direct me, to take care of all my needs. Something tangible, something which is going to give me that security.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Isn't it true, though, that there's a certain number that's attached to the Hebrew letters?
Yes.
That's a different thing, though, right?
Different than what?
Than what you're talking about as far as power,
Oh, yeah, of course. It's merely for instead of having... We have in the English, we have letters and we have numbers. Hebrew doesn't have that. So the way Hebrew has numbers is by giving a numerical value to each letter. So you write certain letters in order to indicate a year of a person's death or a date on the calendar. Or if you want to say, in 7 days, so you'll say you use the letter Zion, which is the seventh letter.
Okay, I don't have...
There is something else you may be talking
about, like Abraham, when you attach the numerical letter to that or something, it has some significance to the different letters in the name?
Yeah, there is a thing called gematria, which means that there's a certain value if you sum up the letters of a certain word. And
right.
I never really studied it, but I do see that the rabbis had used it. I do know that they say that Ibn Ezra says, if you take a look in Ibn Ezra, Genesis 14, verse 14. So it's easy to remember. So he says, any person who really is capable, he can work out a name or letters to indicate good or to indicate bad. Meaning, if you're really capable, you can work out letters and stuff. So he wasn't a big fan of this. There may be certain things that were passed down, you know, and being that it's God's language, certainly there's, like they talk about the word redu. In Hebrew, redu means to go down. So the Jews went down to Egypt. And the numerical value of redu is 210. And that happens to be how long they stayed in Egypt. It's 210 years. So you have things of that nature. You have Moshe. So Moshe Rabbeinu, so the letters in his name, so backwards it spells Hashem. So you have many things like that. Each one has to be looked at. Is it coincidence or is it some sort of an indication? Is there something divine involved? For example, when Moses changed Joshua's name. So Joshua's name initially was Hoshea. So he attached the letter Yud, the Y sound, and it became Yehoshua, or Joshua. And that was at the time that the spies were going to go into the land, and Moses was very suspicious because he saw something was afoot, that God had told them that they'll be able to conquer the land, but the Jews insisted on spying it out. And God didn't tell them to spy it out. So that means there was a level of mistrust. And even the princes were requesting this. Of course, Joshua and Caleb didn't. They were righteous. So they were the only two out of the 12 princes that came back and defended God's word. But the princes were very frightened of the stature and the cities that they saw of their enemies that they were about to take over when they were about to enter the land. So Moses saw in Caleb that he was independent enough that he'll be able to defend himself. But he saw in Joshua a need for a certain crutch, a certain support. So he changed his name. He told him, your name is now going to be Joshua instead of Hoshea, and I'm attaching a letter from God's name to you. That just means that it gave him that psychological strength to fortify himself. Because evidently Moshe saw that Joshua had a need and Caleb didn't. But there's nothing to it. There's no power in the letter like people think. And there's many instances where you have names changed. God changed names at certain points. He changed Avram's name to Abraham to talk about he's going to be an Av amongst the nations. So God gives the meaning over there. When Rebecca has Jacob, so that was due to the fact that his hand was clutched on his brother's heel. So the word heel is Akub. So she called him Jacob, a similar name. She saw that there was a certain personality, and it was an important thing for some reason that Rebecca saw to give him the name of this personality trait that she saw being expressed at his very birth. So again, each case has to be understood. I'm sure there's different insights into each one. And what about gematria? I mean, is there the letters? Are they coincidence, or are they, in certain cases, there's something indicated through that? Well, I mean, it's God's wisdom, so it's not a difficult thing for God to create a language that certain words are going to have certain additional indications, maybe through numerical values somehow. So that's definitely possible. But like you said, it's completely different than other people. They think they put some numbers together, then certain powers that this person I was speaking to. So there was a feeling expressed that certain numbers have certain power. So the question is, where's the evidence to this? Without the evidence, you don't accept things. Otherwise, you'll accept Jesus. The person heard it, which was good. Sometimes the person defends their beliefs because that's something which is a security. But here the person was listening. So that was a good thing. A lot may have to do with the presentation, not to be confrontational. but to really crystallize the argument, make it very succinct, and then put it in their lap.
You know, you don't, what's that word, where you keep on pushing your point,
filibuster. You don't filibuster the person. You just, like, you know, keep them talking for half an hour when you can make your point in a half a second. The best thing is to make your point succinctly and let it resonate. Okay, any other questions?
I do have another question.
Go ahead.
So, my understanding from, if I've got it right, from Rabbi Chait, is that with certain limited exceptions, Noahides are allowed to take on Torah commandments, but they are not supposed to take on rabbinic commandments, because rabbinic commandments are given to the people of Israel in order to ensure the continuation of the system, and that is not a Noahide's responsibility. And therefore, taking those on would be a form of adding to the system, which is prohibited. So, if a Ben Noach wanted to, say, keep kosher, then presumably right now, as I understand it, the institution of kosherus is a combination of Torah and rabbinic commandments that have been established for quite some time. Is there a convenient way for a Ben Noach to be able to discern in a particular area like kosherus or something what the Torah commandments are versus what the rabbinic commandments are? Is that clearly delineated somewhere?
Yeah, sure. It's not going to be something that I know of in a separate book, but if we're just aware of what the Torah says. You know, just a few instances, it's talking about milk and meat and certain species of animals. Right, so there's few areas, and that's what comes to mind readily in terms of what is actually the Torah law regarding kosher.
So if I pick the area to fill in, you have to go to the Talmud to get an understanding of even how to fulfill the Torah commandment. And I assume there are other rabbinic commandments along with Tefillin.
Right.
So in a case like that where you don't have all the information in the written Torah in order to fulfill the commandment, is there a way to discern what's explanation of the Torah commandment versus additional rabbinic commandment?
Well, again, you're saying, the Torah would be further explained by the oral, which is not rabbinic. That's also Torah. The rabbinic is what they instituted subsequent, because Moses got two things at Sinai. He got the written Torah. And that's a good point you're raising. So it wouldn't just be limited to the verses, but like you're saying, since Tefillin are not described in the Torah, what are they? So the actual Torah structure has to be accessed to be obtained through the oral law, the Mishnah. And so I guess that would be the same approach in terms of kosher. The Mishnah can be consulted in terms of what any ramifications are, what this animal really is, any ramifications in terms of the split hoofs, so the chewing of the cud, what more, I'm sure there's plenty of details in there. So it's not, it's a good question. How would that be, a concise separation between the Torah laws and the rabbinic laws? Not a small thing. Not a small thing.
Okay.
I'd definitely like to hear Rabbi Chait's response to that same question.
And I assume that the Shulchan Aruch is a mixture of both?
Yes.
Rabbinic and Torah? Okay.
Yeah.
And it probably doesn't say, any particular spot, this one's rabbinic, this one's Torah.
Well, you'll have different views, so when that comes down, that's going to be rabbinic, unless there is a dispute on what the Torah. But I would venture to say that that's clear in terms of what the Torah law is. In terms of, like you're saying, the Shulchan Aruch will bring down the Torah law as well as what the rabbinic ramifications are on that.
their interpretations. And, you know, because we have, you'll have both for the Ashkenaz and Sfarad, because it's two different main customs. So, but it'll tell us both. Will it separate? We'll have to take it by a case-by-case basis, I guess.
Okay.
Without looking at in front of me.
Yeah. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
In the case of kosher, if I understand correctly, like chicken and cheese can be eaten together. That's a rabbinic command, correct? So if you were Noahide keeping kosher, would that mean that you would eat chicken and cheese together because you're not following something in the rabbinic command, but you want to eat, say, meat or goat and cheese?
Yeah, correct. You'd be able to eat poultry and milk products together. You know, based on what Doug is saying, he says with the Rebbe Chaitin, he said that the Noahide is not to be taking on the rabbinic. So that would be permissible fully to a Noahide.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. All right. Okay. Was there anything else, Doug?
No, thank you. I'll stop asking questions so you can go back to your original lesson plan.
No, no, it's all right. If you have other questions, it's fine.
No, actually, those were the two I had, so thank you.
Okay. Okay, so we're back in the beginning of Chapter 9 in Kohelis. And we touched on it for a few weeks. That's just because we didn't do it last week. And I think we had 1 week off. So, King Solomon basically stated that he's talking about how the righteous people, and this is 9:1. The righteous people and their students. So all is really in God's hand. Matters that they love, matters that they hate. They don't know when and where things will take place. So right away he's talking now about the righteous. Right? We've said, Doug, well, we had a question there. Why it left out the wicked people there? I think you had an answer to that. So he said, let's take it slow then. Right. We may have said because the wicked can be completely outside of God's control. But at least the righteous is going to be providence. I think that may have been what I might have said.
So then to clarify that point with regard to our email discussion about God's justice and that example that Maimonides gave of Reuben and Simon or Shimon, where one's a tanner and he's poor and his kids die and one's a perfumer and he's rich and his kids live, he seemed to be saying that God's justice lands on everyone. This seems to suggest that the people who are righteous and wise are in God's hands. And if I understood your email answer right, you were saying that it's understood that God's providence would only devolve directly upon people who are above a certain level. And so in Maimonides' example, both of those people would theoretically have been at that level, and so God's direction in their lives would have been categorized as God's providence.
Well, his rule is that, you have to read more than just that one chapter, the letter to Marseille. For some reason, it was not in there when he talked about providence, but you see in the guide, I think I sent that chapter out to everybody, that he says, having, you know, explained
that, you know, there's providence and that reaches man, but it depends on the level of the person. Some people can have a great degree of providence, and some could be like the animals. We have to keep that in mind, that yes, there is providence. It only extends to human beings, not to inanimate things or animate things without intelligence. Only intelligent beings receive providence. But you also have to know another rule, and that is that depending on the level of the person, there's different degrees of providence. And some can have a great deal of, and he gave examples, like Moses was on the highest level, so God was with him always. And people who are completely ignorant of what God, you know, what God is, certainly they have no providence, and they're just left with a chance. Like, he quotes King David, they're just equated to animals, meaning animals, there's no specific providence over the existence of a certain squirrel, a certain bird. No providence whatsoever. There's providence over the species. God wills that the species is continuing, but he doesn't will what this specific, is this lion going to eat that zebra or this zebra over there? Right? That providence doesn't exist in those cases. So that a person could be so far removed from an intelligent life that he'll be just left up to chance. And like my mind, it says, there's nothing that can protect him from what might befall him. So perhaps that's why he's saying here that at the beginning of chapter 9, he's talking with the righteous, because they're the ones that actually will have the providence. And he says, one second. Give me one second. Like Ibn Ezra says, they don't know when certain things will happen. Whether things that they love in life, things that they have disdain for in life, they don't know what will come before them. So this is one of the concerns that people have. And you'll see Ibn Ezra says later on, in a couple of verses, that this is, he says further, we should go further actually, because he says, this is just an introductory statement. He says, it's all of this I've placed in my heart and I've searched out. All of this, he says, he repeats it. Right. Yeah, in terms of the righteous, so then there's no real way to estimate when the good will happen to them, or whether things that they don't know when certain events will take place. Things that they love, things that they have disregard for. And then he says, let me see if Sworn has a comment on that. Sworno says that even when a person plans, so he still needs assistance from God, that things should come about. Sworno also says that a person, there won't be any real distinction. He won't know whether or not or when God will step in and assist him, greater than he might assist his fellow. Yeah, but
Okay, let's go to the next verse, because I think this will bring it out. He says, all happens equally to everybody. He says, a kol kasher the kol. All that happens is just like all that happens, meaning to everybody. One occurrence to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the pure, and to the impure, the one who sacrifices, the one who doesn't sacrifice to God. Like it happens to the good, it happens to the sinner. Like one who swears, and like one who takes, or one that fears an oath. Excuse me, the one who, Nishba, the one who swears, he says, is the one who swears vainfully, or one that guards his swear, meaning a good person. So now he spells out what the issue is, right? There's this, it seems to be that what difference do you see between the righteous and the wicked on earth? It seems to be there's one occurrence. Now, what is the one occurrence he's talking about? Is he talking about the good or bad life, that there's negative things that happen to both? Is he talking about death? Because he says in 3 now, this is an evil over from all that is done, that is performed under the sun. And this is where Ibn Ezra says, there's no greater question than this. There's no more difficult question than this question. Alright, so it's either talking about the fact that death meets everybody, or that the events in life, negative or good, seem to be experienced by both. Now, we're not saying what measurement, but certainly we see that people who are intelligent, they follow a wise life, they have much less problems than a person who's careless and makes foolish decisions. Of course, a careless person is going to be met with problems. His life is going to be fraught with conflict. But he's saying that you still will find certain cases that the person will be great and righteous and so on, but, you know, something negative is happening in his life. So this is what people focus on, and this is what their questions. They're looking for the earthly experiences to justify the choices that people make. And this is exactly the theme. This is the real issue that King Solomon is focusing on. So first he talks about what the complaint of the people is. All right, and he says later on again that these are the questions and the attitudes of people, not his own opinion. All right, we've said that many times. So he says, this is the evil that I've seen that's performed under the sun, that one occurrence happens to everybody. And he says, I'm reading in 9:3, and also the hearts of the sons of man are filled with evil and foolishness in their hearts, in their lives, and also afterwards, towards the dead. Meaning that they look to the dead, and they ridicule it, and that's an expression of their foolishness. Because again, what does he say? He says that there's something which is under the sun, which is the biggest question. And that means earthly existence. All right, so when he says that, he's telling you that this is where the person is. Again, numerous times we talk about this, that the people make an assessment, their values, only based on what they experience on earth. And if things aren't justified here, they come up with a conclusion of what is good and what is not good, what is worthwhile and what is not, what is justice. And they look to the dead and they have a foolish statement about it. That's what he means in 3. Because since they're assessing everything based on what they see here, so now they're making a conclusion regarding the dead. And what is their conclusion? Read verse 4. Whoever is attached to the living, he has hope in life. Because a living dog is better than a dead lion. Okay, so we did this. But there's one big question we didn't ask on that. You see, now he verbalizes the question people have, but then the statements that they make. Now, we really have to dig in to understand what is underlying that statement. We can understand that people are just convinced of life, and that's what this is clearly in 4, the beginning of 4. Whoever is attached to life, he's got hope. Meaning that's the only thing worthwhile. So therefore, they make a false assessment. And they say that death, that's it. That's the end. That's why he said at the end of 3 that they have foolishness in their hearts in their lives and also regarding death too. Because that's their, that's part of their assessment, is a misnomer about the experience of a human being. They think that death is the end of the human experience. Well, in a way, human experience, but not our experience. Our soul continues, of course. But this is not the way people view things in life. And this is something which they may see people die, and they, all the time, their closest friends die, but they feel they're not going to be touched by it. There's this feeling of immortality that is able to deny it and never really face it and accept it, that they're going to be leaving this earth too. That's something which they've never experienced. So only what's under the sun is real to them. So therefore, they come away with a statement that it's better to be a living dog than a dead lion. Now, why do they have to make that statement? Why don't you just say, "Is whoever's attached to life, he's got hope. If you don't, if you're not attached to life, so that's it." But why, what now is added, we have to ask, by the statement that a living dog is better than a dead lion? We didn't ask this last time.
Well, Rabbi, doesn't the lion represent, you know, something great, greatness, but what good is it if you're dead? Isn't that the statement here being made?
But didn't they already say that in the beginning of the verse? They said that whoever's attached to life, he has hope. So what more are you gaining by bringing the other statement, the rest of this verse in?
No, because there's a comparison between the two. I mean, the dog is a pitiful creature eating scraps or, you know, whatever. And the lion is something great. I think there is a difference between that statement and the first statement.
So you're saying that with the additional information is that not only is life better, but even the lowest life is better than death?
Yes.
Okay. So can you explain to me why he brings in animals? Can't you use a human? Isn't that what we're talking about? What does animals have? Yes.
Well, I had a thought that maybe it's because animals are instinctual, and so they're living according to their purpose in life, and then it has more to do with purpose, that as long as you're alive, you have the capability to fulfill your purpose, and, you know, man's purpose in life is to continue his intellect, his thinking, development of characterization.
Well, animal wouldn't be a good example to embody intelligence. I mean, it seems to
be... No, but they're a good example of living in alignment with their purpose.
I don't see him focusing on purpose. I mean, he's... I'm just bothered by the way... I mean, he's bringing animals in, right? I mean, he's quoting, you know, the foolish people, of course. King Solomon is quoting the view of foolish people here. And this is what they say. So he's saying this is a foolish statement, but there has to be something additionally foolish besides the fact that they say that life is better as long as you're living, then you got some hope. Now, you're saying that he brings in animals because it's illustrating... I'm not following. Say it again.
Well, as long as you're living, there's hope. You can continue perfecting yourself, and that is the purpose for man.
But he's not talking. This is a ridicule here. Keep in mind, he's not. This is not King Solomon giving his own advice. This is him quoting the foolish views of people.
Okay.
So that we have to look for.
We determine that.
Excuse me.
How did we determine that he's mocking the popular view here and this isn't him speaking? Because it seems like it's a continuation for 3.
Yes, but 3 is the view of those who are under the sun, right?
Because you look at Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra says it openly on verse 8. He says that the proper interpretation of these verses, that's above and below, that they're all joined. These are the words
of the hearts of men, as if they're speaking with their soul. So he says in verse 8 that the verses above and below are all the words of man. So that's where I get it from. It's evident as we're saying it openly. But he says earlier too that from, where does it say? He starts counting and he says in 8:14, from the beginning of this verse until the verse, quote, "This also I have seen, that the wisdom is great," right, which we didn't get to yet. So he says from 8:14 through 9:13. 8:14 through 9:13. All right, again, I'm reading Ibn Ezra right now on 8:14. He says from this verse, 8:14, for another 16 verses, they're all one matter that are joined together. So based on what he says there, and based on what he says that these verses are all the speech in 9:8, that these all these verses are the words of man. That's why I'm saying that this verse here, that it's better to be a living dog than a dead lion, are the verses of people. Yeah, and there's a lot of what you're saying online. Better the lowly are dead than the great. I'm not sure what you're saying. I think he means is just to quote the
book. Ibn Ezra is saying that even verse 1 is just what the people think.
Good. Yeah, that's all part of it. All these verses.
Okay. I'm okay that we're going with Ibn Ezra, but based on my commentary, it appears that Rashi and maybe some others take a different view on that.
Right, it could be. And, you know, as often. What makes most sense to me, though, is a statement like this is not a wise statement. The statement is that to say that better to be a living dog than a dead lion, why are they bringing animals? Let me just answer my first question. Why are they bringing in animals? Go ahead, Jim.
Do they use animals because the people with this view don't see anything better in humanity than that they are just another breed of animal, that there is no purpose? And so the only greatness, you know, a lion achieves is not really any wisdom or Torah knowledge. They don't see that aspect in humanity, so they compare humans to animals.
Very good. That's what I was thinking, too. I think you actually said it better. That they bring in a non-intelligent being because that's really the core of their issue. Since life is really the only thing of value, so the most primary example is even life, even without intelligence. Meaning, if it's life per se, so then even life without intelligence is still going to be superior to, to anything dead. Even a dead wise man. Nope, a living dog would be better. They don't go that far in that statement. But you see, look at the next statement. What's bothering them that they have to say the next verse? But you see, Cal, where I was going with this, it's a ridicule. So I was looking for not a beneficial aspect of it, but a person say it's, to say it's better to be a living dog than to be a dead lion doesn't sound like the words of an intelligent person. Because an intelligent person is not going to assess something based on just life alone. So I think just a plain reading of the verse tells you that it's not an intelligent statement. But then there's something which bothers them. What moves them on now to verse 5? Verse 5 says as follows. For the living know that they will die, but the dead, they don't know anything. And there's no further reward to them, for their memory is lost.
See, I would make an argument that if this is a mocking, that the regular people wouldn't talk about the term reward.
I disagree. And the reason I disagree is because they're saying there is no reward. They don't recognize anything eternal about the soul of man. So when you're dead, you're dead. That's their view. There is no reward. The dead know nothing and they have no reward. So you might as well be alive and enjoy life while you're here.
Right, but they're contrasting. I'm assuming that when they say they have no reward, the they means the dead, not both the living and the dead.
I agree.
Okay, so I would presume that if we're talking about people who don't even recognize, you know, the Creator, that they wouldn't use the term reward in talking about regular life.
Why not? Why can't they look for certain benefits? I work hard and I get this beautiful home.
Yeah, but that's a benefit. I mean, I could be wrong as far as the Hebrew goes, but in just reading English, when it says they have no more reward, it just seems like a term that forgive the use of the term religious, but that a religious person would use, not a non-religious person.
Yeah, I think it's more, you know, mundane in this verse. But what do you see standing out in the verse more than this? Look, we can come back to this, Doug, but I want to focus on something which is repeated. When something's repeated in the verse, he's trying to put stress on it. What does he repeat in this verse? For the living know that they will die, but the dead, they don't know anything.
I'm not seeing it.
Yeah, he's the word knowledge is twice. What the dead know, what the living know. The previous verse, they're talking about how a living dog is better than a dead lion. But perhaps a person is only, can only be so oblivious. Certain things will have to be faced, even by a typical human being. So a person could feel that, yeah, life is better than death, and, you know, a dog that's alive is better than a dead lion. But something bothers them about that statement. They're completely ignoring the fact that there is knowledge that a human being has. So they have to address that too. And I'm thinking that's what comes next. That knowing that they are humans and they have knowledge, they have to address that. And let's see if it fits into their philosophy. So they continue. And they say, yeah, even with living people who have knowledge, look at the living people, they know. I mean, because we are humans. So the analogy of the dog and the lion only goes so far. But in order for them to accept this philosophy, they're going to have to now apply it to themselves. So sometimes a metaphor is good, it makes a point, but then does it really fit what we're trying to say, meaning about the human existence? We're trying to answer the question about human existence, and we just spoke about animals. So that's what they do. They now take this lesson and they say that, yeah, that the life and death, our assessment that life, anything living is better than anything dead, will now apply to the humans. We already showed it by animals. Now let's show it by humans. How? Because the living, meaning the people, they know that they're going to die. So even humans have it one up than the dead. But the dead, they don't know anything. So if you want to bring knowledge into the picture, meaning we were just talking about, you know, non-intellectual beings, just instinctual, you know, animals. So to apply that to the humans, so we have to bring the fact that the human being has knowledge. So does our analogy work? And they say, yeah, they look for a way to show. And what do they say? They say that the living know that they're going to die, so they have greater knowledge than the dead. So here's another example of how living is better, how life is really better.
Okay.
You see? And they continue in 6, in 9, 6, by saying not only in terms of the intellectual side of man, but even man's passions, all of his love, his hate, things that he's jealous about, it's all lost, meaning when a person dies. And there's no other portion for the dead anymore. And all that's done under the sun, meaning they have no part anymore in terms of passion. Just like knowledge they're not a part of, see, even passions too. And now they can finally say verse 7, which is, go and eat in happiness your bread, and drink with a good heart your wine, because this is what God really wants for you to do. Now they can make a conclusion about their philosophy. They've been able to force this theory that life is better than death. So I just want to show you, I think, the framework and the steps that the people are making, that King Solomon is you know, formulating over here. He's giving a structure of what the steps are that people will make and how they face certain issues and how they can, you know, fit their theory into even the human question. Yeah, even knowledge. All right, so you're right. We talked about a dog and a lion, so maybe it's not the best analogy. But we'll apply it. Yeah, it does work by a human being. Because look, the human being, he knows that he's going to, the living person knows he's going to die. He's, even in the area of knowledge, he's better. Even if you want to bring that element in. And even in the area of passions, the living are better. So therefore they say, immerse yourself in the living and eat and drink and so on and so forth. Now they found justification. Right, this is basically where they get it from. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die. This is right where they get it from. All right, any questions? Does it make sense to you?
I just have a hard time accepting it.
Why? Which specific point is it?
I have a problem with Ibn Ezra's basic presumption that this entire section was written as a mocking of people. And I realize that that's his interpretation.
Right.
But for some reason, some of these verses seem to me to be like 7, you know, I mean, go eat your bread joyfully and drink your wine with merry heart, for God has already accepted your deeds. I suppose that can be, well, if that's him mocking the people, or if that's he's paraphrasing the people's belief,
yeah,
then that presumes that the people have accepted that there is a God, because they're referring to it.
Yes. They accept that.
But then it sounds like he wants to hold that in verse 5, they have no more reward because their presumption is that there's nothing after death.
That's right.
So he's saying that the people are holding there is a God, but there's nothing after death.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, you know, the Sadducees believed that, Doug. It isn't uncommon for groups to believe that there is a God, but that they don't believe that man is eternal. There are groups that believe things like this.
Oh, I know. I understand. I mean, I'm noting that Rashi and some others interpret it in a very different way, and so I'm scratching my head thinking about, gee, this is interesting, because here's this guy who wrote this book, and yet the commentators take very what appear to be very different views about what he's saying. And that just makes me scratch my head and wonder, well, what did King Solomon really mean then?
Yeah, let's take Rashi then. Let's take a look at Rashi and understand where he's coming from. He starts off let's take Rashi from the beginning, 9:1. So how does Rashi understand all this? So he says, I searched all this out. clarified, and I tested it. And then he says that the righteous and the wise and their servants or their students, their lives are in the hands of God. And Rashi says, he assists them and he judges them in order to do good for them at the latter end. And also their servants. These are the students that minister and go in their ways. And the verse says also their love and their hate, all these different things. Rashi says, Ein yodim shar habrios. I guess the other people don't know this. And they don't give heart to the matter. For what is love before God? Or what they hate? Everything is before them, Rashi says, before the righteous and the wise. What does he mean by that? I don't know. Then in verse 2, where it sounds like it's making a statement that the good and the bad seem to have, there's no difference. So what does Rashi said? Hakol kasher lakol. All that happens to this one also happens to that one. Rashi says, Hakol knows them to leave them. All is given to their hearts. Kashemagia lacho odem, Mikra Echo, when their approach is to man, their meets all men, one type of a fate. And they know that the end of the matter is that each man will be given his just deserts. So Rashi is saying this is a justice. This is talking about real justice. He's understanding this as a description of how, when it says a kol kasher the kol, he's saying that each man will have his just rewards. Mikra echad, there is one event that happens to everybody. What does Rashi say on that? The yodin, and they know that the end. Shesof HaKol, Asher Tzadik, Asher Rosha. Right. Whether you're a righteous person or a wicked person, that you'll die. And there's only one way in the world. In this world. For everybody. All this they know. And even so, they choose for themselves the right path. Because they know that there is a distinction. In the next world. Even though there is an identical fate on this world, what causes the righteous to choose the righteous path? Because he knows that there is something more. There is a next world. Then he goes through a bunch of analogies of who the righteous, the pure, the impure are. He gives analogies. Who's the righteous? That's Noah. Who's the wicked? That's Paro. He's equating the righteous to the wicked, and he said they both had similar things happen to them. I'm not sure if Rashi says that he had a limp. What, do you have the English Rashi, Doug?
I have a translation of it, or this includes him. Which verse are you looking at?
In 2:9-2.
So I have for 9:2, such as Noah, such as Pharaoh Necho. This one became crippled, and that one became crippled.
Okay, so he's saying that.
Good.
So you see what he's doing. Rashi's also showing that. You see, in this life, you could have two people, one's righteous and one's not. You have Noah who's righteous and Paro who's wicked, and they both became crippled. So where's the justice in that? So Rashi is going along with the plain understanding of the verse.
causes the severing of the spines.
Right. One thing happens to the Tov. This is Moses, and to the pure, this is Aaron. And also, on the other hand, the same thing happens to the people that are impure. Who are these? Rashi says, these are the spies. For these said, the praise of the land, meaning Moses and Aaron, so the praise of the land of Israel. And these, the spies, they spoke about the degradation of the land. But neither Moses nor Aaron nor the spies went in. They had the same faith. So Rashi again is strengthening the question of, you see that whether you're good or bad, you have the same faith. Noah was good, Paro was bad. Both of them got crippled. Moses and Aaron were good, the spies were bad. Both of them, all three of them, did not enter the land. So you have a similar faith that happens to you whether you're righteous or whether you're not righteous. So Rashi is embodying the same question that Ebenezer had, okay?
And he seems to be saying, in this world.
Yeah.
He seems to be bringing up the world to come a couple of times.
Right, well, we said that too. That Ebenezer is you know, the that it has to be under the sun. I think that's clearly what King Solomon is doing. Okay. Let's see what Rush says further. Let's see where he deviates from Ebenezer. This verse, let's go to the next verse for a while. Yeah, so Rashi says on 9:3, that the heart is full with evil. So what is Rashi saying? What is the evil that people are filled with? So going to Rashi, that they say there's no judgment of punishment for the wicked. Again, ein din peronios of Hashem, ein hakol el lefiha mikra. It really just happens accidentally. Sometimes it happens to the righteous person too, and sometimes it happens to the wicked. So the saying, there's really no rhyme and reason to the fate of man. Okay, and I don't think that's a deviation from Ibn Ezra. Let's see if he deviates in the next. So the next verse was the statement that people make. Whoever we are understanding Ibn Ezra as being King Solomon vocalizing the false views of the people. And what was the false view? The people say, as long as you're living, you got it good. That's it. Death, that's it. Nothing happens afterwards. And what does Rashi say in this verse? For whoever is attached to living has got some hope in life. So Rashi says, while you are still alive, even if you're wicked, and you attach yourself to wicked people, like it states, to all living things there is hope. Even to the wicked, there is hope. Perhaps he will return before he dies. Okay. So here's where there's a deviation. Rashi is learning this verse to mean, it is a statement of King Solomon, that according to Rashi, it's a suggestion to repent. So when it says that, and it's a true statement too, it's not false. So both could be accurate. But they're taking different paths in terms of understanding the intent of the verse.
It's a very interesting take on the live dog and the dead lion, I see.
Is it Rashi?
Rashi, yeah.
Okay, let me get to that. That's the next one. For the live dog is better than the dead lion. What does Rashi say? V'shneihem rishayim. Both of them, if they're wicked. These are references to real people. V'shneihem rishayim. There was good that happened to Nebuzaradan, right? Because he was a wicked servant, and he converted. But he didn't die earlier than Nebuchadnezzar, his master, that was called a lion. And he proves in reverse, Ali Aryeh, that there's a reference to Nebuchadnezzar, that he was considered a lion. But he died in his wickedness, and he went to Gehenna, and a servant went to heaven. Okay, so what does he mean by that? He says, better off to be a living dog than to be a dead lion. I mean, living dog means that Nebuzaradan, who was a servant, he repented, and he's living, and he went on to heaven. So now that would follow what Rashi's previous statement, that you should repent. And you see that this person did repent, so he's better off. But then he says, the rabbis explain this matter differently. They say, cut up a piece of non-kosher meat before the dogs on Shabbos. Yeah, so they say if you have a piece of meat that's not kosher, so don't throw it out, feed it to the dogs on Shabbos. That you can do. It's permissible to take the non-kosher meat and give it to the dogs on Shabbos. But let's say a person dies on the Sabbath, right, and he's sitting out in the sun, and he's going to start to stench. It's still prohibited to move a dead person. So he's trying to show you, see, it's better to be a living dog because they'll get the meat, and then a dead person who dies on the Sabbath, you can't even move him. So you can't do anything for him. What's his lesson?
There's always hope while you're still alive, but the door is shut once you die.
But Rashi was taking a position where Nebuzaradan was the one who repented, and he went to heaven. So Rashi, I thought, was taking a positive instructional type of an approach over here. So how does this fit in with his approach? Do you have Rabbi Moskowitz's class today, by the way?
Yeah, we do.
You do. Tell you what, why don't we look over Rashi? I did not look at him at all in this. And let's do this next Sunday. Let's see if there's how it carries through. I don't see any contradictions between Rashi and Ibn Ezra. They're just taking two different paths in terms of understanding what the words are, what the words are meant.
Is Rashi speaking to the Peshat, though? I mean, he seems to be reading a lot of things into this that are not clearly supported by the text.
Okay. I'll look into it.
I guess I thought that a major difference, which maybe we could explore, is that Ibn Ezra seems to be saying that King Solomon is explaining what the people believe, not what he thinks. Whereas Rashi seems to be taking the position that, no, this is Solomon talking directly, and here's what it means.
Yes, exactly. That's definitely a divergence. Yeah, like he equates who's the Russia, that's Paro. Who's the Tzaddik, that's Noach. But there he seems to be on the same page as Ibn Ezra. He's just giving concrete examples. But they both agree. They see that the good and the evil both seem to be meeting with the same fate. But that's clearly what the verse says there. But then King Solomon goes on to more of a cryptic type of whatever. A verse in verse 4. Whoever is attached to the living, he has hope. Now it's more of a cryptic thing. All right, we'll have to see what we can do. We can derive from both. But I think at least according to Ben Ezra, we see some sort of an interesting path that the typical people take. They first talk about the dog and the lion, but then they realize that they have to apply it to themselves, so they have to bring knowledge into it. That's why in verse 5 they have to say that the living know they're going to die. So they bring knowledge into the picture. So I just want you to see that. And then they go into not just knowledge, but even passion, love, and hate, and jealousy in verse 6. So I just wanted to give some framework. You know, I always like to see where is he going. There's got to be a rhyme and a reason to how King Solomon's working. So we could show that, you know, and that fits in better with Ibn Ezra. I lean towards that way. Especially since, you know, the statement, literally, is, you know, understandable according to Ibn Ezra. That is a foolish statement. And, you know, the rabbis did also say that they want to hide away this book because it sounds like, you know, it's King Solomon saying things were negative. But the way we're explaining it, like Ibn Ezra says openly numerous times, it's not my opinion, King Solomon says, I'm merely vocalizing the words of the people. So that would explain why, another reason, that the rabbis would maintain this book. They said the reason why they maintain it is because the conclusion of the book was proper. That he ended properly, that this is well of man, they should do God's mitzvahs. All right, we'll continue. I know it's getting late. So we'll pick up next week. Any other questions or comments before we wrap it up?
Yeah, there's so much to learn. It's so much clearer when you explain it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, okay, everybody, so have a good week, and we'll pick up next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi. Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure, everybody. Have a great week.
Be well, everybody.
Bye-bye.